In this episode, I take you on a journey to how the recession-hit city of Liverpool in the 70s influenced and shaped my good friend, Mike McElroy. Mike is the co-founder of Liberass Solutions, and his team, well before the pandemic, have been using their wealth of experience in ERP in supporting enterprises becoming more sustainable. And Mike's vision is not just around how organizations source and manufacture their goods, but it's fundamentally down to how organizations treat their people. This conversation was triggered by a series of blog posts that were written by Mike that introduced this concept of carbon accounting. He explores the business framework that Mike and his team have been using to steer organizations on their roadmap to start undoing decades of environmental damage. I'll put a link to these posts in the show notes of today's episode. We unwrap Mike's thoughts around why an organization driven by an engine that focuses on sustainability will be the one that wins in this new economy. The fact that it's young people and not government that are driving this shift in attitudes, and how the pandemic has not just heightened our awareness of the environment that is our planet, but our homes, our family lives, and how this distributed model office, that is us working from home, will evolve to shape our futures. This conversation was recorded a few weeks back, and Mike has a unique ability to leave behind a signature of statements that effectively ingrain themselves in your mind. I've been finding myself quoting Mike and his thoughts in various conversations since recording this episode. We start this story in the incredible city of Liverpool, one which has been an economic gateway into the UK for goods and people. A city built around its docks that enabled the diversity and culture that made it a beacon of creativity and enterprise around the world. But when an economic recession hits, it's always been one of those cities that gets hit harder than anywhere else. Hey, this is Bobby, and welcome back to another episode of the IT Contractors Podcast. As you know by now, this is a show where I share authentic stories. I cover almost two decades of hard-learned lessons. And from those hard-learned lessons, I try to share messages that are agnostic, allowing you to apply those to your professions, your business, and even your personal lives. Now, before we get into the core of today's episode, I just wanted to remind you to either pre-order or pick up a free copy of my new ebook. It's called The Top 5 Contracting Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. I'll put a link in the show notes and provide more information at the end of today's episode. Mike, I think it's fair to say that you spent your formative years growing up in the city of Liverpool. And how did that period of the 70s with the economic depression that hit the city so hard, not just shape you, as in the Mike McElroy that we all know today, but also, what parallels could you possibly draw from some of the economic impacts during that time to some of the things that we're seeing today?
It's actually a fascinating question, because for a number of reasons, you know, it did shape me and it shaped my general outlook and view on life, because Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, particularly around the 80s, I suppose, in the Margaret Thatcher years, was one of those cities, and it's always been a very sort of left thinking politically, and a very sort of socialist heart ground. And because it was, and still is to a large extent, the government of the day, certainly under Mrs. Thatcher, took it upon themselves to, I suppose, put Liverpool to the bottom of the list of any requirements and any sort of social input. And I think It is true to the fact that, you know, that there is mass poverty and mass unemployment still there in comparison to the rest of the rest of the country, where there is a certain affluence. And I guess it does, it shapes you as a person, because you do get a sense of community and you get a sense of social responsibility, because you see what can happen to people in tight economic positions. And I think, you know, you look at today's world, where people suffer through poverty or suffer through lack of opportunity, there's more haves than there are have-nots today. And I think because the haves tend to find it, some people find it difficult to understand how a have-not has got themselves in that position, or how they can't just get themselves out of that position. Why are they going to food banks? Why are they struggling to educate their kids properly, and et cetera, et cetera? Whereas someone, and I don't want to sort of like come over as some sort of Citizen Smith, Che Guevara type, but you know, someone who's come and seen that. Don't get me wrong, I was very, very fortunate as a kid. My mum and dad pretty much sacrificed everything they could. We weren't, certainly weren't rich people. My dad drove a van and my mum was a receptionist at a doctor's. But they sacrificed everything for me and my brother to have every opportunity possible, and which is why we went to one of the best schools in Liverpool, and we had all the opportunities of university and further education based on what my parents sacrificed. And again, that feeds very much into my psyche on how I raise my kids. I give them every opportunity, but I also make sure that humility and grounding is the most important aspect of them as individuals and them as people. And I think all that does is ground you as an individual, but it also, when you actually go out to business and you go out to do your job, you look to actually add value in whatever aspect it is. You know, I guess I've struggled over the years when we have sort of family reunions, etc. When they ask my brother what he does, well, he's a consultant surgeon who saves lives and has many war stories of how he brings people back to life or saves young children's lives, etc. Whereas my war stories are more centered around how I've shortened the month-end calendar for a telecoms company, or I've implemented a P2B system, and isn't that clever? And you generally get a sense of, well, where's my social input there? What have I actually contributed? Where's the value in what I do? And I think that what's exciting about now and exciting about the technology and the technology areas that I'm working in and looking at is that you can actually now start almost putting your sort of feelings and thoughts into your delivery. And this is what's got me so focused on this sort of carbon accounting concept, is where you can actually help business help themselves, but also help the ecology and help their environment and help their workforce. And there's such a groundswell towards that way of looking at things. If you look at an Amazon advert, Amazon's adverts are every night, and never do they really talk about Amazon. They talk about Amazon's people and how the people at work at Amazon, how they feel and how Amazon looks after them as associates. You know, you will look at a car manufacturer. The other night, I'll give a clear example. Three adverts following rapid succession. A car advert for a Fiat telling you that half the car is made out of plastic, but not just ordinary plastic, ocean sourced plastic, recycled plastic. Everywhere, every company, every business is recognizing that green is good, and being seen and acting corporately and socially responsible will bring customers to you. And that's really quite fascinating. Mm. It's really fascinating, in fact, because, you know, for years and years and years, the mark of a good corporate engine was that its people were efficient. You know, we always looked at the Japanese and the Chinese and said, my God, their people are efficient. They can do stuff better than we can. Whereas now the feeling's more a case of, yeah, but do we look after our workforce better? You know, we don't treat them as commodities. We treat them as true assets. And I think one of the things that's really brought that home is COVID. Everybody has one feeling about this whole thing, and I think that's fear. Everyone has seen how vulnerable they are and how vulnerable their families are, and the priority in their lives is being refocused to their home life and what's important. And therefore, you know, business has to respond in the same way. But I think there's always been that kind of prejudice that, you know, if you are working remotely, you're bound to be just skiving. It's forced people into kind of understanding that, yes, things still happen, even though people may be remote. And then the individual themselves, they're happier. You know, they're happier because they're not spending 4 hours a day on a motorway, but they're also happier that they're contributing to the family. They're having meal times with their kids. They're helping them home educate. They're tucking them into bed every night. You know, working in the IT industry particularly, you know, there was always that sort of, I suppose, two-edged sword where, yes, you made great money, and yes, you saw the world, but yes, you also had to sacrifice a great deal of home life. We've all been there on a Sunday night with feeling like rubbish, packing your bags, ready to go away for another week while the kids are getting ready for school. And, you know, where your focus and priority is, should be the people that are most important to you.
Mm. And Mike, I can totally relate to that, because, you know, for me, that moment that you leave the house for a few days or even a week, almost felt like that had the most impact on the kids.
Yeah.
And I always used to try and leave on a Monday morning whilst they were still sleeping. Even if that meant that I had a ridiculously early start on that morning, because that always felt easier on them than them seeing me leave on a Sunday evening. And even for myself now, I guess being positioned at home for so long, you really see that value of that family time, that if this event hadn't happened, I simply wouldn't have had this opportunity. And Mike, there were a couple of things that I actually want to pull back on, as there were a few streams of messages that were coming out from what you explored earlier. And three words stuck out for me: people, fear, and vulnerability. And those are key ingredients that go into the recipe that can really catalyze change.
Yeah.
And just drawing us back to Liverpool in the 80s, you touched on that Thatcher period when the 80s recession hit, and the approach the government were taking at that time was that Liverpool was too big of a problem to deal with. And from what we know now, there was a contingency plan for the government to abandon the city. And Mike, was that the sentiment in the city around that time, that almost felt like they'd been abandoned? And how did the city pull together to invoke change?
Yes, and I think there was the full knowledge, because we at the time politically, we had sort of the Derek Hattons of this world and etc. And obviously Scarborough with the miners' strike. But in Liverpool, we had a very left wing local council, and they very much galvanised the people behind the thought that, and it was an open secret that, you know, Thatcher was setting about effectively demolishing the city. And because, you know, the city had taken a few knocks, you know, it was built around the docks anyway. And then when the Manchester Ship Canal opened, a lot of the economy moved that way down the East Lancs to Manchester. So there was a general degradation anyway. So really, I think economically it was seen that, yes, it could be rejuvenated, but politically it was just too much of a war on their hands. So it was left and it was ignored. And I remember my dad, just as I went to university, my dad lost his job at the age of 60. And, you know, it was a scary time from a family point of view, watching a man that, you know, had worked his backside off for his family, effectively being put on a scrap heap. And luckily he was able to get work through past colleagues and past a network of friends, if you like. And and that's another thing why, again, it kind of reflects on what I do now, that, you know, having networks of past colleagues, you almost have a responsibility to them when they're on the phone. I know what it feels like when you're looking for work, and, you know, and especially, you know, IR35 and COVID and soon to come Brexit, people will be, you know, sort of losing their jobs, or the industry will be changing and people will be scared of being sidelined. And, you know, I saw him struggling to try and find to get back on his feet. And it everybody is quite happily as vulnerable as the next, and nothing is certain. And I think, you know, as people in the industry, we all have responsibility to each other. And I'm not plugging Libra Solutions, but this is why my colleague and I came up with the idea of Libra Solutions, of not just making sure that we can pick the best people because we've worked with them and we can offer that to clients and customers, but also to keep that sense of community, and, you know, sort of look out for each other and have each other's backs. And I think, you know, the world is moving more that way. You know, it's not rare now to do shopping for your neighbors if they're in their 80s. It's not rare now to take full responsibility for your parents as they get older. You know, it's the social care problem and general people care issue in society is definitely being highlighted, and it's in no more stark evidence than during this pandemic. It's weird. The analogy I had in my head was, it's almost like we know that, you know, the last few years, shall we say 5 years, the rise of sort of populist politics and isolationism, mm-hmm. and let's face it, racism is just going the wrong way. We are now almost going backwards in areas that we thought we were very well developed in. And it's almost whether this pandemic feels like a reset. It feels like there's a greater power somewhere has kind of flipped the world on its side, found the factory reset button and stuck a pin in it, because it has refocused people's priorities. And I think when you double down on the rise in sort of young people's awareness of politics, you know, young people have better ideas when it comes to politics because they're more idealistic. They're not cynical like us old hacks. You know, they have better trains of thought. And, you know, to our shame, they get bricks and everything thrown at them. People criticize them because the message they're telling people, it doesn't sit well. You know, people see it as a threat. It's the reflection that not government, but people are actually changing the market and changing the world, and changing priorities. The more companies' websites you look at now, the more focus there is on corporate and social responsibility reporting. There's even pages devoted to it, and again, their ability to retain and look after their workforce is a lot more important than their ability to produce cheap as chips little widgets that come out the back end. And when they do make those widgets that come out the back end, they responsibly source it. I found an interesting group which kind of reflects that as well is this sort of, I think they're called Transform to Net Zero. Microsoft joined them very recently, mm-hmm. but they are just enterprises like Maersk and Mercedes who have just formed a group together. They're in disparate industries, some of them horizontal, some of them vertical in terms of the integration, but they've just formed together to help each other in terms of research and knowledge, and maybe even in day-to-day business, to improve their own carbon footprint and their own social responsibility. And I think that's amazing. I think it's incredible, because it kind of says you can still be competitive, you can still be a capitalist, you can still make money, but you don't necessarily have to leave a great big dirty hole by doing it. You can save people's lives, you can improve the world, you can improve your workforce's life and your customer's life. And in reward for that, customers will look on you favorably, and the market will reflect on you favorably. Governments will allow you to come and build sustainable plants and factories in their countries, your markets will expand because you are a socially responsible entity. It's actually quite a fascinating period. It's although we sort of sit there in this darkness and think that, you know, it's all, what's next? When's the meteor landing? You know, you do kind of look and you think, yeah, somebody somewhere has made an intervention, and I don't mean Huawei. You know, a greater power has decided that we need to start again or have a real shift change in thought. And I think that's what we are doing. And I definitely see that for the first time in a very, very long time, probably maybe ever, in the 30 years that I've been doing this, there is more. There's less sort of snobbery about people first and people's putting their lives and their responsibilities mm-hmm. first.
And Mike, I completely agree with that sentiment. And for me, your use of the word reset, I find that quite empowering because it almost feels like the right word. And if we use the UK as an example, we've been hit by a perfect storm of pandemic, Brexit, and climate awareness, and they all have a relationship to each other. And if we focus on environmental awareness, yeah. It's interesting what you've touched on about younger people correcting our own view. And you know, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and that happens to me all the time. and for her, environmental activists such as Greta Thunberg have really helped to shape my own daughter's political views. And like you said earlier, we're all in that generation where we can be set in our own opinions. And, you know, I've got to be honest, when we look at environmental awareness, my view used to be, and I have to admit, I'm ashamed to admit it, is that I didn't really care. Because for me, reducing my carbon footprint felt like a huge inconvenience.
Yeah.
You know, I even found recycling a chore when we first had to do that, you know, over 10 years ago. And ironically, countries such as India have been recycling for centuries out of necessity, setting a standard that the globe has largely been ignoring. Mm-hmm. But it's those younger people that, as you said, are shaping those values and pushing that onto us. And I find that really interesting. You know, people like Greta Thunberg are influencing my daughter, making her more aware. And that drives mm-hmm. real change. I find that fascinating.
Yes, and it is. And strangely enough, when I always remember growing up, people that were politically aware or people that were more politically active at the sort of younger ages were the ones that maybe went off to uni or where the influence was more. I did all my marching when I was at uni, and you know you were more politically aware, and also maybe because of the background in terms of the city where I was from, it was political changes were a bit more stark and in your face, but there was always that sort of criticism of, well, young people don't get involved in politics. Well, that's no longer the case. You know, I've got three daughters and every one of them is, since the age of about 14, 15, has held centre court and always wanted to tell me what they think about this, that and the other. And whether it's whether it's local or national or even geonational sort of politics, they're interested. Mm-hmm. And it's good. It's, you know, it's rewarding and it's encouraging because the more aware people are, the more educated people will make themselves if they want to be more aware. And the more educated people will make themselves, the less stupid and bigoted the decisions will be, the less narrow-minded and maybe isolationist that they will be. And we will have better thinkers. Because one of the things I suppose that, you know, we're faced with is there is this other thing where technology is advancing at a rapid pace, which is great, and it makes opportunity, but it also puts things at risk, just like the Industrial Revolution. You know, some people have said this is the fourth Industrial Revolution with the advent of AI and more robotics. You know, I guess being a finance consultant, I've always worked in probably the most boring area of a sort of back office, financial, AP, AR, GL, all that sort of reporting that people just kind of think, well, it's just bean counting. And it is becoming more commoditized. And that's why that's now being centered more around sort of AI and robotic processing. So then what happens to those people that, you know, that the actual physical people that that may replace? And there is a challenge, and that's where government, you know, I've said before that, you know, industry themselves and people themselves will self-police their own carbon footprint and their own responsibility. But where government needs to set in is, right, now we've got people who may no longer be needed. We've got more robotics, I suppose, you know, on a production line, you can, robotics is more obvious, but robotics and bot management of transactional and back office processing is on the rise. So therefore, where do we put these people? Where do the people that lose their jobs now? You know, there is, you know, you put them to thinking, mm-hmm. you put them to these sort of analytical jobs, which we've always said in the industry. Oh yeah, you know, you can spend more time doing more value add activity. Absolutely, but we've got to identify what that is, and if that's, you know, investing in the green economy, you know, why are we importing wind turbine technology? Why are we behind with, you know, vaccine immunization? Why can we not be the center of a biotech industry? Because that's the way maybe the world is going. Why can't we reinvest in our social care programs and have, you know, care homes as palaces, not these sort of dilapidated, privately run houses? And you know, you can look to government then and say, right, you've now, you know, we're doing our bit, this is your bit, you've got to now invest at a sort of a macro level to tell us where these new industries are going to be and how we're going to invest in them. And, you know, I think, you know, Elon Musk was going to build one of his hyper factories up in the northeast and moved it to Germany, and this is where government needs to step in. You know, was the Brexit decision a cause for it? Could have been. There's an argument for it. I mean, greater minds will be able to argue the case either for or against. But, you know, we need to be attracting those sort of jobs to fill the gaps that are being made. You know, you look at the other thing is, you know, I guess the most stark example is retail. Everybody knows the high street is dying, and that's because you can click a button. And we go back to the Amazon people who, remember, their advert tells you they're nice people. So you carry on clicking and buy your stuff that way. So that means that the retail front end will now start closing down. So what do you do with all those shops and those buildings? Well, maybe you open it up for social housing or for university students. I see that more and more in the inner cities now, where universities and education is big business. And if you don't have travel bans and you can get air bridges working and you can get foreign students coming over, you know, you bring billions of pounds of revenue and research and thought and knowledge, and you know, you become a knowledge hub, not necessarily an industrial hub. And you also can help the social housing crisis, and you can give people starters on the ladder, or you can get the homeless out of the streets. And, you know, so there's all sorts of things that you can think, and that's where government needs to be. That's where their policies is. And I think what is encouraging is that the things like the emissions and the, you know, the sort of the Paris Agreement requirements are being reflected. You know, you see Vodafone have announced they're going to be carbon neutral by 2030. SAP want to be carbon neutral by 2050. You know, Microsoft 2030. You know, so they're all sort of going towards that way because they recognise that if they don't, they will suffer on the bottom line. Not because government will give them massive fines. I mean, most of the time, government's not even taking the right tax off them, let's face it. So government ain't going to pick on them. But who will pick on them will be the consumer, because the consumer will stop buying their stuff and will buy somebody else's. So they even the most cynical capitalist would have to agree that there needs to be a more responsible way of doing business. It will pay dividends, pardon the pun. So there needs to be an investment somewhere centrally to try and get a new economy, a greener, more sustainable economy going, and one that will see us into the next millennium.
And Mike, there was a momentum to setting zero carbon emissions targets well before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And obviously the pandemic has now accelerated this. But it does make you reflect on the way society can sometimes think about things that we don't want to do now because we can't see the physical benefit. And you know, sometimes if we apply some of the challenges of upstream thinking to this, people don't want to invoke change because they can't see the benefit that change will bring. And we've seen that all over the world now with the reduction of travel to work, planes grounded, cars garaged, and buses stopped. And all these things that Greta and all the activists behind her were telling us were proven in a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike, if we look at this acceleration, you focused your business to help organizations achieve carbon zero targets well before the pandemic.
Yeah.
By implementing solutions, to not just monitor, but also to project outputs. But are you now seeing a direct translation in demand for these solutions, actually now increasing because of the events of today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mentioned it a little early, but on some companies now, even when you go onto their website, there is a devoted page for what they call CSR or corporate social responsibility reporting. And, you know, as I say, there's large organizations like Mercedes and Microsoft, Danone, Vodafone, you know, all these companies are looking to form alliances further up the supply chain as well. Because, of course, you know, you give an illustration. You go and buy a mobile phone from Vodafone, you will buy one if it's, you're more likely to buy one if it's ecologically sourced, if it's marketed that way. So therefore, the pressure is further up their supply chain for the people who give them the phones in the first place to provide something that is ecologically sourced. And then the manufacturers of the phones will then go back to their providers and then will also then look at their supply chain. So then Maersk may be bringing iron ore from the Africas to these manufacturing plants. Well, they're going to find a way of improving their distribution channels and how they're actually transporting this material. So it's all got a knock-on effect, and I'm seeing that right now. You know, I'm seeing it. There's growing companies where I'm doing some work there with a very exciting company called Emmetwise, and they are looking at producing, sort of dashboard reporting, not to sort the problem out, but to help companies very quickly and relatively cheaply find a way of measuring their flight path, measuring, you know, where are we? This is where we are now in terms of our footprint, and this is our entire product line, and this is where the carbon footprint exposure is. And then if we want to get to net zero in 30 years' time, by the end of year two, we're going to reduce this production line, or by the end of year three, we're going to improve these raw materials. So they can actually start strategically planning and forecasting based on some of these tools. And as I say, if you go to a lot of websites now, they have CSR sort of devoted areas. If you on LinkedIn, a lot of the announcements from most of the big FTSE, you know, 250, every 5 minutes is that another thing that they're doing that will improve their carbon footprint. And it is a bigger driver as anything, I think, in terms of, you know, sort of the bottom line. You know, when as I say, implementing ERP systems for 30 years, when you went in there, the first sort of questions were, you know, how, you know, from finance, yes, how can you shorten my year end and my month end? From the production guys, how can you centralize my manufacturing? How can we make this cheaper? How can we make it quicker? How do I not use so many people? How do we get these things out the door? But never a question of how do we do it more responsibly, or how do we do it where there's less pollution, or how do I do it where there's less byproducts, or how can I recycle products? So there's more direction in towards all of this probably in the last 5 maybe 10 years, but then certainly in the last 5 years a lot more focus, and this has really put it at a pinhead and has opened up this whole social responsibility conversation a lot more, because it's in everybody's face. You know, it's like anything. You know, none of these concepts are new. The hole in the ozone is not new. You know, the requirement to recycle our stuff is not new. We've been polluting rivers for the last 50 years. We know we have been. But now it actually means something to people because they're seeing it right in front of their faces. And it's not, to coin the phrase of the old Great Orange one, fake news. It's actually happening. And there's no argument around it. And if you do argue around it, let's face it, you look a little bit deranged. You look as though you're the crank now. People that are, you know, sort of denying all this and telling you the 5Gs are telling you what your brain to do. You know, they're the ones that look like the cranks. Whereas years ago, the people that had said that you needed to, you know, eat vegetables and save the planet and save the fish finger, etc., they were the cranks. And they were the ones that people pointed at and laughed. Whereas, so you see that sort of step change, and you see it definitely in the market. And I do think, you know, I think there was a quote recently from McKinsey saying that the next entrepreneurial billionaire will be somebody connected to the green economy.
And Mike, it almost feels as though you're projecting your own future here. and you know, and that's an interesting response, because one of the things that I reflect on whilst I sit in my own bubble here, like I have for the last few months, is it's actually about creativity and innovation.
Yeah.
With so many more people now grounded, working in their, you know, in these distributed offices that are our homes.
Yeah.
And this time for me has allowed me to be more creative with my own skills, but it's largely because I've had the bandwidth. I haven't been involved in a large scale program that's been sucking up all my energy. Yeah. And I found more avenues to not just network, but to change the shape of my own business. Mm-hmm. And Mike, if we explore innovation and creativity through a different lens, mm-hmm. with let's say the driver for more people permanently working from home, being the environmental benefit of reduced travel,
yeah.
Do you think we're getting an accurate measure for how creativity and innovation is potentially being impacted at this time? Because in all fairness, teams aren't necessarily able to fully connect.
That's a very good point, actually. It is a very good point, because yes, I mean, individually, we've got time, and individually we've got time to you know, to debate with ourselves and think about and research. But I think there is a risk of that, but then there are obviously our mechanisms, and maybe that's one of the things that, instead of, you know, like, yeah, how many times have you attended meetings? If you're in the office, it's almost a case of like, well, if you're in the office, we should at least have 3 meetings a day. We've been on projects ourselves where, you know, you have a meeting in the morning with the same people at lunchtime, and then the same people at 4 o'clock. And when they ask you at 4 o'clock, why haven't you done what we discussed this morning? You think, because I've been in bloody meetings all day. But maybe, you know, there's a mechanism there where you can target those groups and target those discussions, because it's less arduous. You don't have to find rooms. You don't have to collate everyone. You don't have to sort of like move everybody. Maybe if they're in disparate offices, maybe this is an opportunity where half an hour, 1 hour every week, you have the thinking room where everybody joins and they just discuss innovative ideas, mm-hmm. ideas of, you know, this is stuff that I think we're doing that we should be doing more, or this is stuff that we haven't even thought about. Well, should we maybe put this into our ideas or our concept or our business practices? And I think, you know, again, you can invite a wider audience, a more diverse audience. And, you know, it's very difficult to find, you know, 30 people sitting in a room and housing them, because there's just physically not those sort of locations. Whereas if things are done remotely, if things are done by these sort of technologies, you can be a lot more innovative and more outward and inclusive in those groups. You know, you can have a chairman sitting there listening to a bunch of people from the warehouse or the factory or the shop floor or the, you know, the back office, just discussing their ideas about how they think things could improve. And those ideas can then be monetized, and those ideas may be incentivized by paying people for those ideas. And it's easier to capture them if they're able to articulate it. And maybe not face to face, because some people are threatened by that. Maybe they can do it over the phone, you know, over this sort of thing, you know, with your video switched off, you feel more comfortable and more happy to and in your own surroundings. So there is there is the danger that the coffee discussions that you have, or the water, you know, the water butt discussions that you have at work, which is where most of the great ideas and the gripes and the backstabbing happens. You can actually do it in a more sort of scheduled manner, and by doing it that way, you make it more inclusive. So, you know, and again, it's all depends on what environment that you're in and what sort of situation that you're in. But I think that there are definitely mechanisms and methods to make sure that we don't lose it. We don't lose that sort of human touch. I mean, you've seen it now. As you know, I've seen my daughters on the, you know, on FaceTime, and they have gin nights and quiz nights with their mates during a forced lockdown. Well, now that they can meet up again, they're still doing it. You know, and it actually improves their relationship. So, you know, one of my daughters has come back from Colchester University, so all her friends are all over the country. So she hardly ever gets to see them if you just think of the traditional method of jumping on a train or in the car. Whereas now, because they've gone down this route of FaceTiming and group FaceTiming, it's now the new norm, and they do it once a week, and mm-hmm. it's their night out. They get dressed up, and they get, and you know, and it's those sort of things that you're seeing in social world we'll see in professional world. You know, there's all sorts of things that may improve corporate life, and you know, you can actually make the world more inclusive this way, but still not forgetting that, yes, we can't all be 100% remote, because if we are, then we go the other way. You know, we go from one extreme to another, where we all become just very insular. And so, yeah, I think there's a measured approach to all these things, but it certainly doesn't mean remote working means this is all over. You know, you don't have these things that we used to do. Of course you can. And yes, you can have targeted meetings and approaches. And as I say, cyclical sort of flexible working. They're talking about, you know, in some places, people working, you know, a working week starting on a Wednesday, and some people working on a Monday, and staggering it that way. To make sure that the public transport system can still maintain social distancing, etc. So there's always a balance that you've got to find. But again, you know, with time to think, and with time to take a breath and think of the wider things and not just the daily grind, people will come up with these ideas.
And Mike, what I take from that is our ways of working have to change? Because what we've seen is a tactical move to react. And what we've done is we've changed how we're working, but not necessarily the way in which we're working. And to your point, if we promote the right vehicles and methods to be more creative and innovative as part of that working day, I think there's also an argument that the old way of back-to-back meetings in an office didn't do much anyway to promote creativity in the workplace. You mentioned inclusivity, because, and I find that interesting, because one of the things that I haven't seen a shift in yet, and maybe it's happening, is global inclusivity and access to skills. Because one of the benefits of this, you know, distributed office model, you know, us working in our homes,
yeah,
is that we have access to a wider pool of resources around the globe. And yes, I appreciate, you know, time zones could be a challenge. However, for many of us, we kind of work around that, because a lot of us do work in global teams. But the one thing that I haven't seen a shift in yet is a global contracting workforce. Because I'm still seeing roles for, let's say, UK contractors being positioned in the UK. And not necessarily seeing organization sourcing from a global pool.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I think that's another opportunity that COVID has certainly given us that, because and it is touched on in conversation, and it's been touched on with conversation between ourselves, but you know, you hear it. And I think it is a change in working practice and change in general acceptance. That yes, you know, it's a big deal that if you live in the UK and you get a contract in Qatar, then how are you going to possibly do that without, you know, uprooting yourself? And I think the opportunity is that you open the market, doesn't matter where the job is, because, you know, your requirement for not actually being physically located is a lot less. And, you know, especially something like a 3-month contract now, because I can't see many borders being open to travel anyway. So if a project's going on in the next 3 months, then really it doesn't matter where you are, because it's highly likely that you, if you do go there, you're going to have to quarantine yourself and you won't be able to work. So, you know, it, in some ways, yes, you think, well, then that's going to restrict to these local markets anyway. Or you could be innovative in your thought and just say, well, fine, you know. And, I mean, I suppose one example for me was that there was a job that I was after, and they, it was an engineering company that had a big manufacturing presence in Australia and a massive manufacturing presence in America and an office in London. And the reason why they had the office in London is because they could physically house people there that were in between the two time zones. So when the Americans were going to bed, the Australians were getting up and vice versa. So you could have this sort of management of the project was able to span over these time zones. And you think, well, that's a great idea, you know, and it's an innovative idea, and it will push people to think now about, well, yeah, again, you know, if I'm going to do this project, can I do it remotely? And if you can do it remotely, then yeah, absolutely. The workforce, it doesn't matter where you get your workforce from, because as long as you know, you've got somebody who's you've got a specialist in a particular area, and I've seen examples of this where, you know, you may have a particular piece of software that requires specialist knowledge, and it's like an SI may say to a customer, well, we do have a specialist in it, but unfortunately he lives in New Zealand, or he lives in Australia, or he lives in Alaska, whatever. Well, now that doesn't matter. You know, if he's got the Zoom link, then you've got him. And you can certainly deliver things a lot more efficiently. You know, we've seen it in our past clients, probably, where most people, you know, where I think hand on heart, we could probably have delivered our last project 100% remotely with the odd trip into the office to have a sort of a boardroom meeting or a program board meeting or anything like that. And, but again, as we say, once or twice a week, because the mass of the work was being done in the Indian subcontinent, and we were in the UK. So, you know, it doesn't replace the need for change management. It doesn't replace the need for face to face. And again, maybe that project was a very good example of it, because yes, there were the occasional trips down to India and to the UAE, but predominantly the whole thing was remote, and it worked brilliantly. You know, we did the work, we got it in, it was on time, it was on schedule, and under budget. So there is, and I think that's the thing. COVID has proven that it can be done. It's just going to be a cultural shift in people thinking, actually, I don't have to think like that anymore. I can think like this. And this is where it ties back to giving people more time to think. If you can be global in thought, global in maybe even resource, and if you're going out to 20 markets, then why do you need to have just one country's thoughts in terms of your resource pool? Why is that project team now not inclusive of all those countries? And you can be inclusive, because you don't need to move Joe Bloggs from one side of the world to the other. You can talk to him for half an hour every week to explain to him how the designs are going off and get their input into it from their aspect. So you can actually become more global in thought and delivery and design from the outset, because a lot of our restrictions in the past have been how we physically locate ourselves, or how we actually, you know, the traditional view is, well, if I want to go and find out how Italy produces its tax reports, I'm going to have to jump on a plane and go and talk to them in Milan for a week, and they're going to show me all their reports. Or you're going to have a one-day workshop with the guys remotely first. I'm not saying you don't go meet them, but you go meet them, but you don't necessarily have to stop everything until that happens. And they can show you those reports by Teams or by Zoom or by scan or by email, and you can still be inclusive and get that information. And that's not new. That's always been possible. It's just COVID, the pandemic, the lockdown has changed our view on how we do business, because business has still been done, and no one's had to jump on a plane to do it. So you think, after COVID, we don't necessarily have to jump on the plane every week. We certainly will do, but we don't have to do it with the frequency that we did. And we certainly don't
have to say, well, we can't do a design workshop because we can't jump on a plane. I've been on a project before where there was an Icelandic volcano blew up, and that grounded the project. That actually became a problem for the project. The project stalled because a volcano went off in Iceland because flights were grounded. And the accepted view was, well, if we can't jump on a plane, then we can't do the work in XYZ country. Well, that's nuts. You could, but the view was, well, yeah, but it's not the same, is it? Well, the view is different now. The view is, yes, it is the same. And in fact, the view's better because you can actually travel to Italy, Germany, Holland, New Zealand, Optimupti, Albuquerque, all in the same day without leaving your seat. And you can actually get a lot more done. So I think the globalization in terms of workforce and delivery it's slowly changing, and you see it more. And again, it's something we've always done, but something that is not the norm, and it's moving towards the norm. And I think we will see more and more of it. I hope we do anyway, because then we will see true benefits from it.
And you know, for me, global in thought is something that you just said that really resonates with me, because that's something that really starts to bring cultures closer together and aligns them better than it always has before, and breaks down barriers. And on that note, Mike, I think this is probably a good point at which we start to wrap up today's episode. And I have to admit, I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah.
I've got to know a Mike that has an environmental awareness that I didn't know before. And we've known each other for a long time. But what I want to do, Mike, is just touch on some of the areas of this episode and ask you the question, what do you think needs to happen to ensure that this momentum of environmental change is sustained?
Yeah, that's the challenge, isn't it? And I think that's the challenge in everybody's life and an approach. And certainly, if we relate it to what we do, I think the there have been some barriers in the past. And those barriers are breaking down. There will always be a sort of a step change in terms of people's thoughts, and you've got to move people along. Just like you would do when SAP first came out, and people, you know, the challenge to us was you've got to really sell to people how integrated this product is, and they've got to move away from their thought of, you know, having all these different systems and doing it the way that they have always done it. It's always been a challenge in our job. And I think, you know, this is just another one of those challenges, but one that I think is a little bit more simpler to, or hopefully simpler to land, because people get it. As I say, this has been quite a unique episode in the history of the planet, because everybody, you know, so even Kim Jong-un, everybody is actually saying, bang, this has actually impacted us. And this impacts our daily lives, but even more importantly, that of my wife and my kids, you know, and the most important people in your lives. And so you take that responsibility on board, and then you think, well, you know, how can I change the way I do my business? And if somebody says to you, you know, I don't want to travel tomorrow to Denmark, like you've just asked me to, because my wife is, you know, I don't know, my wife's mother's in hospital and I need to help with the kid. You're not going to get a question of, well, can't you get a babysitter? You're going to get, no, of course, absolutely, you know, not a problem, you know, because the issues have gone away. I think I said to you many weeks ago, but there was an episode when I was on a project where my auntie passed away, unfortunately, and I asked the project manager if I could have the day off. Well, actually, I told him I was not going to be in on a certain day because the funeral. And his first question was, how close were you to her? And it was kind of, what? So I guess the challenge, you know, how to make this change is, you know, we are always being change champions, whether it's been for IT or for efficiency or, you know, technology or improved process or train of thought. This is just another challenge that we have to move people into thinking, yes, we, you know, have you thought about doing things this way without any prejudice that you may have had from the past? And I do have optimism. I do have feelings that, you know, it's not a message that will be difficult to land, because people will see the benefits. It's not just a case of, oh, let's everybody have an easier way of life, which is way it was viewed. It's kind of, look, if you do this, if we do it this way, we can actually be more efficient. We can actually be more innovative. We can be quicker. We can be cheaper, and we can be safer and risk-free. Because again, the same thing, you know, you're in the middle of a project and we get another lockdown, and your processes aren't geared up for having people remotely working, you're screwed. Your project stops. I mean, how many projects are, I know mm-hmm. at least 8 projects that were in flight that were completely stopped because of COVID. And that's not a fault of those projects. That's just because of the normal working practice was not ready for it. No one was ready for it. We weren't ready for it. You saw the farce of the PPE and the track and trace and the test. No one was ready for this. And the challenge now is, don't think this is not going to happen for another 100 years. Something else is going to happen, whether it's this or whether it's something similar or whether it's an exploding volcano. Something is going to happen, and it's going to impact you. And the people that will be successful are the people who are geared and ready for it already. Or maybe, you know, they won't even notice it because it's part of their normal daily practice. So it's not something, it's not a challenge to give to your customers that and to be ashamed of. It's you're not looking for an easy life. You're looking for a more risk-free way of doing business.
It's like we're accelerating our evolution.
Yeah.
And it's going in the right direction.
I think so. I hope so.
Mike, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and there's so many good takeaways from this, from what's influenced your personal journey to how you're now supporting the sustainable enterprise. Thank you, Mike.
No, thank you. Thanks for your time.
And to my audience, thank you so much for listening. I'll put more information about Mike and Liberas Solutions, and even any resources that we've referenced or anything around this subject area that I think you'll find useful, I'll punch those into the show notes of today's episode. And if you haven't already, don't forget to pick up a free copy of my new ebook. It's called The Top 5 Contracting Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. Now, this is a book based on my own personal experiences. I've made all of these mistakes myself, and I have to admit, I haven't just made them once. I cover a whole variety of subject topic areas, from how to manage your cash flow to contract negotiation and even IR35. So I'm going to assume that the book is still in pre-order at the point that this episode is released. But either way, if you click the link in the notes, you'll either get a copy of the book straight into your inbox, or you'll be put on the pre-order list. So as soon as I've actually finished the book, you'll be one of the first few to receive a copy of the book. Now, if you've enjoyed the episode, please remember to hit that subscribe button and rate and review the show on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. And feel free, as always, to recommend the show to your friends and colleagues and spread the love on social media. It really helps me. All my contact details and social media links, as always, will be in the show notes of today's episode. I'm Bobby. This is the IT Contractors Podcast. Thank you for listening.